No, honestly. No one's ever seen this before.
White Hart bows before the princess, father.
He's blessing her.
What are you talking about?
You have eyes, huntsman, but you do not see. You who have been with her the longest. She is life itself. She will heal the land. She is the one. Gold or no gold, where she leads, I follow.
Aye.
I'm with you.
Yes, father.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hi there.
Today we will be talking about the week's big new release, Snow White and the Huntsman, and we'll also be talking about the reasons why G.I. Joe 2 was pushed back. We'll be talking about the new trailer for Les Miserables and the awful trailer for Les the Favorite. And as always, we'll be finishing up with our recommendations. So, circling back to G.I. Joe, we talked about this in the last episode, sort of putting forward our theories about why Paramount did such a drastic delay. And Adam, why don't you lay out for us, just quickly recap what happened and the new facts that have come to light.
Well, Paramount basically gave, within a month of G.I. Joe Retaliation's release, they said, oh, we're going to push the release date back to March of 2013 for a conscientious 3D post-conversion. The reason they gave was that they wanted to post-convert the film to 3D. This sparked a lot of red flags from basically everyone. No one was buying that line that they pushed the movie back that far just for 3D. And so just a few days ago, as Matt predicted, the trades kind of came out with their, you know, the real reasons why G.I. Joe was pushed back. And Deadline was saying that the film's test scores were mediocre to bad, and the main parts of the movie that everyone responded to were the scenes between Channing Tatum and Dwayne Johnson. And as you've probably seen in the trailers, Channing Tatum is only in one location, i.e. he dies.
I thought he fell down a well, and he came back.
The well was how they survived. The well was Dwayne Johnson and Adrian Palicki and DJ Catrona. They were, like, jumped in the well to, like, get away from the explosion. And then it saw them, like, crawling up the well to get out, and they're like, oh no, everyone's dead.
So Channing Tatum didn't survive in the well.
Yeah, so, like, he didn't survive.
Misleading.
Now they're doing reshoots to... apparently they did some reshoots first to bulk that relationship up a bit before he dies. And now with the year of Channing Tatum, he had a great turn in Haywire, 21 Jump Street. They're citing The Vows box office as another draw. So they are pretty much bringing him back from the dead. We don't know to what extent, but apparently the movie was testing really bad. And this is kind of what we said in our podcast that, you know, for a studio to pull their movie this late with that month and they've already shown marketing, like, there has to be some major issues. And so the rest of the movie must not be good.
But the other part of it was, of the story was, Channing Tatum was half of it. And then the other half was, and again, this is according to the studios spinning it their own way and rival studios trying to say what's what. But I believe that 3D, in terms of an international marketplace, really was a driving decision. And I think that's something we easily forget. We look at, oh, this is the domestic box office, and that's what it means, and 3D can't help that much. And we forget that overseas, more and more 3D theaters are popping up. And that boost, when you bring it into a worldwide audience, who actually, I guess, are still going for 3D, that can really boost box office for the relative cost of the post-conversion. So the 3D was a part of why it was delayed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they were highlighting Battleship as an example of that, as how it did poorly, very poorly, domestically. But, you know, internationally, it made 2-3 times. Domestically, now it had been out for a longer time. But
yeah. Well, so did John Carter. John Carter did
exactly.
Well internationally as well. But the thing is, and this is, again, comes back to when we say a movie does well, it's still misleading in a sense that the complexities of what we would like it to be, and I think I've talked about this in the past, is we know a budget, and then we see a box office return, and that's the end of the story. And it doesn't come close to working that way. At best, it's an indicator. So we can look at John Carter and see, oh, it did really well internationally but not domestically. Well, that's probably a good sign that it will maybe do well on the home release market internationally.
Sure.
But domestically, it'll still come short. But we're not looking here as, oh, if you know, Battleship made $200 million overseas and cost $200 million to make, therefore the film is broken even. No, it doesn't even come close when we look at the marketing and the prints and the advertising and the fees and the translations and everything
and
that has to be done.
Reported budget, that's, I mean, the budget could easily be more than that.
Oh,
the
absolutely. Exactly.
So. Well, and that just plays more to why I think that supports what they're going to be doing with this 9-month delay. It's because we already talked about all their wasted advertising. I mean, you just pretty much get rid of all that because people aren't going to remember the posters, the clips, everything, you know, 6 months from now, let alone 9 months from now. So, I mean, you've scrapped that entire budget. That's all wasted money. So they're definitely looking at this international piggy bank as a way to kind of recoup some of that.
Exactly. So I guess the question is will it pay off? And I think that March date is – I mean, it'll probably pan out pretty well. Who knows? That's the thing. Like, we say, well, if it the box office will be X and they spent an extra Y to do this. Like, I think in Deadline story they said the extra cost of the conversion will be $5 million. I'm like, well, fantastic. How much is the cost of remarketing the entire film worldwide? And, Dave, going to what you're saying, sure, there's going to be – people may not remember the marketing. I disagree. I think people – will be confused when March rolls around because they saw this film and they see the posters for it outside the theater, for God's sakes. I was going to the movies a couple weeks ago, and this was after I went to the movies and the news had come out that the film had been delayed. However, at this theater, the poster still reading June 29th was still outside, and now it's down. I went back to the theater and that poster isn't there anymore, but you walk by it. People walk by those posters, they see the ads, they see all that, and then they're going to be like, what? What happened to G.I. Joe?
Yeah, and even if they're not going to actively remember, you know, like even if this isn't something they put on their calendar and then they're going to be counting down the days to the actual release of it next year, since they're doing reshoots, it's not like they're reshooting the entire movie, so there are going to be scenes. The scenes we've seen from the trailers, you know, the motorcycle splitting apart and blowing up the gate and all those kind of things, I guarantee they're going to be in the marketing again. So it's going to be – I agree with you. People are going to be confused by it and just be like, didn't I see that last year? Did that movie never come out? So, I mean, this – I don't know how they're going to handle this in the future, but it's going to be quite a mess.
And I think it's interesting because the playlist, they did this great article about how this is really the latest movie in the trend of doing reshoots and – every movie does reshoots and pickups, but extensive reshoots. So apparently, Carl Eric Rinch's 47 Ronin, you know, that movie got a kickback for to really enhance the 3D, to really make sure they're doing it right. And apparently there's like weeks of reshoots to do, and he may have been cut out of the process or something.
World War Z is doing like 7 weeks.
World War Z is doing 7 to 8 weeks of reshoots. That's like a new movie.
That's a full movie, yeah.
That's like scrapping it out the window. Which is kind of funny because the movie is barely based on the book anyway.
Yeah.
The book is really more of a the way I've had it described to me, it sounds a lot like the opening of District 9, where you see this sort of special effects world, but it's being recounted through interviews.
Right.
And
right.
a sort of documentary style. And
yeah,
it
exactly.
sounds like what director Mark Forrester was going for with World War Z, and what Paramount wanted was a straight up action movie. With a PG-13 zombie film, but basically in the style of Max Brooks's novel, in the sense that they retained his setting. Sort of a person goes around the world and sees the result of the zombie apocalypse and sort of deals with that. But for fans of the novel, it was going to be a very loose adaptation. And now, who knows what that adaptation will look like again, but it's a different story for World War Z, because Mark Forster is established. He's not Rinch or John Chu, who directed G.I. Joe 2. So that one's a little interesting, because I don't know, do you lock him out of the editing room, or is he just like, meh, I don't care?
Well, and I read on, I think it was a Hollywood Reporter wrote up their own write-up on G.I. Joe 2, and apparently John Chu, the director, was gobsmacked by this decision.
Yeah.
And Channing Tatum apparently was really upset. I guess the studio hadn't treated him well at all and they had to do some, like, a lot of kind of ass kissing to get him back to do those reshoots. Apparently, he was not having it at all. He was done.
Wait. Okay, I guess I'm trying to follow why that would happen. I guess maybe they signed him to another contract, and then they signed him probably to a multi-picture deal, and then they killed him off real quickly. Is that why they? Is that why he's upset?
I don't know. It didn't specify. It said that the studio hadn't treated him well in the past. I don't know if they I don't know if he was like too excited about G.I. Joe or whatever. But maybe it was a matter of like, oh, we need you these dates, so you can't do this other movie or do these other, you know, things that you're trying to schedule. Maybe it could have been scheduling, or I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's got a busy schedule now. That's another thing you have to consider is that with these reshoots. Like Brad Pitt, World War Z is a 7-week shoot. He's doing 12 Years a Slave. He has other films on his slate. Like, how does that affect these actors' other commitments when reshoots on a film that they've already shot obviously takes precedence because they signed on to that movie first?
Right. Well, and see, the thing is, I'm still just trying to wrap my head around about what qualifies as treating Channing Tatum poorly. Like, do they walk by his trailer and be like, yo, Tatum, the Eagles sucked, and like they walk on. They're like, dear John, go fuck yourself. Like, I don't understand what, like, treating Channing Tatum badly means, especially if this film, they're going back to, they're like, hey, Tatum, we're going to pay you more money and give you a bigger role in our blockbuster movie. And I guess, Adam, what you're saying, I agree, he's got a busier schedule now, and that's something you have to work around. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you guys think about having him featured in the movie more?
It really depends. Look, I think Tatum is fantastic in 21 Jump Street. I think he's good in a supporting role in Haywire, but I'm not someone who's like, and now I'm sold on Channing Tatum forever. the bad still far outweighs the good, and so for me it's like, maybe he did just get a series of bad directors and writers who worked with him who didn't really know how to connect and use his gifts, because I've talked to people who say outside of movies, he is a really charismatic, funny, likable guy. It's just when those cameras go on, all of that goes away. So clearly it's someone on the production side who can't get through to him. And maybe that's, it's not just one person. Maybe he's matured as an actor to the point where he just feels comfortable enough to really go forward. But whatever the case, I'm not someone where it's like, and now G.I. Joe 2 will be better because with more Channing Tatum.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see the play between him and Johnson, between him and Dwayne Johnson, because, I mean, if that's what was really testing well to begin with, that's obviously what they're going to go back and reshoot. I'd be interested to see how that plays out.
But was it testing well, or was it
testing
comfortably? That's the thing. Right. When we say testing well, it doesn't mean
the rest of the movie.
I'm sorry?
Yes, relatively, yeah.
Well, rest of the movie, but also, when we say testing well, I think we should keep in mind that when we say there's the assumption like, oh, it's testing well because they have good chemistry. It may just be people liked it because they were working well together, but the film throws audiences a dreaded curveball, and I use the term curveball very loosely, that, oh my God, they killed off Channing Tatum. He was the star of the first movie. How can he be dead? Audiences, general audience, like test audiences hate that shit. They hate stuff that plays against expectations in a big way. They don't like it when something like that happens. Like, oh my God, you killed off the star of the first one, or the lead actor and the lead actress didn't get together at the end. What's going on? I don't understand. Someone hold me.
I need formula.
Literally and figuratively. Yeah, so exactly. So when you take that away, I can understand people creating a backlash there, and I don't know if that necessarily means Dwayne Johnson and Channing Tatum are just two peas in a pod and will light up the screen. It may just be audiences were uncomfortable. These test audiences were thrown out of a formula and they reacted poorly to it because they...
Yeah, you know what though? I mean, if you're going to kill off the main guy in the beginning, but then the rest of your movie doesn't pick it back up to get the audience re-engaged and back into it and leave them with some sort of positive feeling coming out of it, then there's a lot wrong with the rest of the film too. Has to be.
Possibly, but I mean, there are some movies where, and some TV shows where if something happens, it so throws you for the rest of the film, where it's like, I can't trust where this film is going, or you did take out the best thing, and now everything is in the shadow of that. So going back, I'm not saying the Dwayne Johnson, Channing Tatum stuff isn't good, but when you have a really strong element and you take it away, it's jarring. So, for instance, I don't know if y'all know this, but with Lost, the original plan was to kill off Matthew Fox's character.
Right. Yeah.
And they were like, you can't do this. You can't do this because he is the audience's anchor. And if you do this, they'll never trust you again. And it makes sense. I understand you want, there's this balance where you want to kill off someone major because you want to raise the idea like everyone is on the table. Anyone here could die.
Right.
Oh, my God. But for an audience, there's a balance there. You can sort of anyone can die, but they need some anchors. They need someone who'd be like, I know I can care about this character at least, and there will be someone I can latch on to.
Yeah, and not to get off on too much of a tangent, but I mean, I'm looking at the George R.R. Martin, you know, school of storytelling now, where he just completely bucks that entire trend, and people love him for it. Love him and hate him for it.
Well,
they're both sides.
I know, but to me, and I think there's the flip side of that is, sure, it leaves you care about people and you don't want them to die, but at the same time, for me, I know that causes me, at some level, to disconnect. And sure. When people have told me that, I mean, they haven't told me specific spoilers about Game of Thrones,
right.
But you are not the first person to say he just kills people off left and right. And that makes me hesitant to really care about anyone in the show. Because it's like, well...
See, to me, it's like, that and that gets me more invested. Does that make sense? Because you know that these people aren't just going to survive, you know, this 6 seasons in a movie or whatever. You know that there's a potential that one of them is not going to be here.
Then you don't know who's going to be a major player and who's going to be around for a couple episodes. So you're like, should I like care about this person at all? Like, what are they going to like? Are they going to be around? Are they going to kill them off?
And also, what is the purpose of the death? That's the other thing, because deaths that are just done for shock value become very tiresome. Game of Thrones has
sure done over and over and over. Sure.
Right. Well, they should have some thematic weight or some serious storytelling weight, sure. Rather than. The shock value isn't enough.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I feel maybe, you know, that G.I. Joe thing, had they not given it away in the trailer, probably would have just been a shock value thing to show everyone's on the table, but not really. No one's expecting you to kill Dwayne Johnson.
No, I think the general plan was like the first G.I. Joe did fine, but obviously they weren't happy with it. So they were like, well, let's have Dwayne Johnson be the star, and they're like, should we just reboot it? Like, no, let's just throw the other guys in at the beginning and kill them off.
let's throw in one guy. They didn't even bother bringing anyone else back. They just...
Which is crazy, because, I mean, the G.I. Joe catalog of characters is enormous, and they decided to just, like, you know, shred them all and just pick up with 2 or 3 or 4. I don't know how many they have, but that just seemed crazy to me, to isolate them down into this small group.
It did seem odd to just scrap everybody, especially when none of the cast, no offense, has, oh man, their price tag really ballooned after the first one. I mean, I'm pretty sure you can get Marlon Wayans back if you ask nicely.
Smiles and a cheese sandwich.
He's like, I want 2 grilled cheese sandwiches. And Paramount's like, no, you are not coming back. Channing, he's like, I'll have one. And it's like, good, you can come back for 5 minutes of the film. Paramount, with all their grilled cheese sandwich budgets, they have the best craft services, pun intended. Oh, I'm so happy with that one. All right, let's move on to Les Miserables. Let's dream a dream. That first trailer came out and got a really positive response on Twitter, the internet. People seem to really go for it. For those who haven't seen it, there will be a link in the post with this new podcast, but... If you don't want to check it out for some reason, you don't have that extra minute and a half to watch it. It's basically clips from the film with Anne Hathaway singing I Dreamed a Dream played over it. And it works pretty well. Dave, what did you think about the first trailer for Les Mis?
Yeah, I thought it worked really well. When I saw it just on my computer, you know, I was really into it. I was definitely caught up in the moment. I loved just trying to catch all the glimpses of the different scenes and all the incredible cast that they have in this, and just try to see their look and get a feel for the movie. And then just that fantastic song, and Anne Hathaway's performance was very good. And the fantastic song that just went along with it perfectly. It's like you didn't need contemporary music like a Baz Luhrmann trailer to like throw into this. You actually just used one of the best songs from the score to accompany all these clips, and I thought it was fantastic. I liked it even more when I saw it today in the theater on the big screen with an audience, and the audience responded to it quite the same way.
Adam, what about you? I know Dave, I don't know about you, but I know Adam and I are like going nuts for Les Mis. Like, we can't wait for
yes.
it.
Yes. Oh, man. Adam? And I absolutely love this trailer. And this is coming from someone who is not really a fan of Tom Hooper. I didn't love The King's Speech, and his whole low-angle close-up style in Jot Adams killed me. But I think it suits Les Mis very well. I mean, it's not – when you're watching it, not only like do like the actors look great, and I love how they juxtapose the song with the visuals, but it doesn't look like just a cookie-cutter period piece. Like, it has like those low-angle close-ups like work, and they bring you into the story. And just the way he shot everything, that sweeping shot of the barricade at the end, I got chills. And I saw it in a theater as well as Dave, and I saw it in front of Snow White and the Huntsman. It was a really giant theater, and it was packed, and the audience clapped after the trailer. There was applause after the trailer played. I think this movie is going to do really, really well. And creatively, if it's not up to snuff Oscar wise, I don't see why the production design and everything doesn't get, you know, bukus of nominations and awards.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't see it with an audience, but I've watched it a few times online. I really like it. I can understand there was the criticism about Hathaway sort of sing talking it. You know, she some of it's a little sing, and then some of it is her talking the line, and it really should be her singing the entire time. But the thing is let's see the whole song in context. Let's see the whole number play out rather than just her singing over it. But I think one of the interesting things is this is from a business standpoint, Universal has stayed out of the awards game for a while now. That just hasn't been their business. They go for their blockbusters and more popular films, but they're not trying to get into the Oscar race. And this teaser is already, it's like, this is a costume period piece with a huge scope, and please just nominate us now.
Yes.
Trust us on this. We want, cause, and they usually don't go for that. I mean, looking at their past movies, they'll maybe do international distribution on a film like Moneyball,
and then they make Battleship.
And then they make, yeah, but for the films they make, I mean, they make Battleship, but they also make Bridesmaids and Fast Five and The Adjustment Bureau and The Dilemma and The Change-Up. I mean, those are the kind of movies they make. They make movies that will appeal to a mass audience. And it's not that Les Miserables won't, but unless they have someone like Ron Howard, who they just want to keep that relationship going, so they'll make Frost Nixon, which doesn't really cost a lot of money, this is a really big investment for them.
Oh, yeah.
And I like what I'm seeing. I like the look at Hugh Jackman as Jean Valjean and Russell Crowe as Javert. And really, I would just love to see more numbers, more music from the film. I kind of knew, the first one's going to be set to I Dreamed a Dream because that's the most popular song from the musical. But I hope at some point we get a trailer set to One Day More. It just seems so perfect for – but also it would show you the whole – a trailer like that shows you – or a number like that shows you everyone in the movie.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, we didn't get a look at the I can't pronounce their names. The character. Who played by Helena Bonham Carter and Sacha Baron Cohen. We didn't get a look at them, and you got to have Master of the House in that movie. You can't.
But what I love about this adaptation is that all of these actors sang live on stage. They're not singing to a backing track, which is obvious with the Anne Hathaway performance. Like, yeah, she might have like sung talk some of it, but it feels so raw and real. It's not like Rock of Ages where it sounds like Glee, where it's just produced the shit out of it. Like, you were hearing these voices pure and raw. And like, when he was casting the roles, he cast people like actors and voices, like casting a Broadway show. He cast both. So I'm really excited to see that. That's what, I mean, I can't remember the last time we saw a movie musical where, you know, the songs were recorded live on stage.
Well, they were recorded and they were probably re-recorded. Let's put it that. They were singing on.
Well, the report that I saw was that they had the microphones on set and they were recording the sound on set. Like, they were literally like that was what was going in the movie.
Well, it depends on the number. I mean, we've seen in that set video of the finale when they're singing at the barricade and they're playing back the singing so that everyone can hear it. They're not. Yeah, exactly. I'm talking about that kind of scene, something where so much is going on. It would be impossible to just pick out those voices. But we've also seen videos where I think Jean Valjean is running out of a church and we can hear Hugh Jackman singing, you know, holding a note as he runs out. And so there, I think there's a mixture going on. But like you said, that song was probably recorded at least the first time. And, you know, there's ADR on everything. So it's not to diminish her performance. But she was really singing her heart out, like, on the set. And that's a big deal because of the way films are made, in the sense that you have to keep doing shoots and shoots and shoots. So she's not, like, she's singing the same number throughout the day with no rest, and for a film shoot. And more than that, she has to sing sections of it. Yeah. That's another half of it. She can't just sing it from start to finish. She'll have to say, okay, well, now the camera's here, so we need you to sing these bars or whatever. So that's also a little difficulty thrown in there. But I love the way it's all looking to come together. I'm very, very, very excited to see this film. How about a film? I've already seen it. I've already seen it. But this week we got a UK trailer for Stephen Frears' Lay the Favorite.
Do you want to see it again, Matt?
Oh, God. I so don't. Ever. Never, ever again. There were two films I was really excited to see going into Sundance. Lay the Favorite and Spike Jonze's Red Hook Summer. And those were the two films I hated the most. I hated them. Those are the only two films I gave an F to at Sundance. They were both so bad. And Stephen Frears is a good director. He's done The Grifters and High Fidelity and The Queen. And he's good at his job. And this is a train wreck and a half. But for those, you know what? Here, let me step off a second. I watched the trailer. Dave, do either of you know the plot? And if you did, assuming you did know what the plot was, if you watched this trailer, would you have known what it was?
Yeah, so when we were talking about doing this today, covering it and talking about it, I had no clue what the plot was going into. I didn't even know who was in it. I didn't know it was a Stephen Frears. The title didn't sound familiar. So I just did a quick IMDb thing. I knew it had something to do with a gambler and a cocktail waitress. I have no idea what this movie's about after watching that trailer. Like the first half of it, I was kind of like, okay, I kind of get it. Makes sense. And then the second half of the trailer, I was just like, what the fuck is going on? I have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, I can't tell you what the movie's about based off the trailer. The trailer seems to have no idea. It doesn't want to sell the movie for what it is. And it's not that the movie's hard to follow. It's just obnoxious. Basically, Rebecca Hall plays this woman who's a former stripper, and then she goes out to Las Vegas to be a stripper and finds that apparently those positions have all been filled, and she wants to be a cocktail waitress, and then it turns out she, despite being someone who is a bimbo and a half, like, this film will almost make you hate Rebecca Hall. Like, all the goodwill you've built up, like, I like her in The Town, and I like her in The Awakening. Like, every movie you've liked her in, Lay the Favorite threatens to erode that goodwill. She talks in this little baby doll voice, but anyway,
it's irritating as hell.
Yeah, do 90 minutes of that, guys. Listen to her talk like that way for 90 minutes.
No, thank you.
Do it! No, thank you. Like, you have a choice in the matter, sir. Anyway, so she turns out to have a knack for numbers, and so she kind of gets trained under the eye of this bookie named Dink, I think, who's played by Bruce Willis, and he has this jealous wife. And none of the ideas come to fruition, but I saw this trailer because I was wondering, like, how do you market a film this terribly? And I guess the people at whatever marketing firm or marketing department, they got their hands on this film and they looked at it and they're asking themselves the same question. Like, oh my God, can we redub her? Can she do this? No, we can't do. Okay. Well, I mean, there are movie stars we got. Oh God. Is it con? No. just that pitch. I wanted to just sit in on that setting where they watch the movie. They see that it's gotten no accolades out of Sundance. Like, there's no, like, positive pull quotes they can put on it. And they just watch it, and they're just like, oh, my God. So,
just hoping to confuse audiences and go and see it.
I honestly
I have no idea what this is about. I have to go check it out.
Right. You might as well just at this point just throw out like names on a screen and not show any of the movie. It's like Bruce Willis, Rebecca Hall, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Joshua Jackson in a film from the director of The Queen and High Fidelity, Lay the Favorite. And people are like, I like those people. And they go see it and they're like, why? Because that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. I like those people. And
that's good marketing right there. Got you to see it.
Well, that wasn't even marketing. That was just names on a fucking...
See, that's what their poster is right now. I'm literally looking at their poster, and it's exactly what you just said. It's exactly to a T what you just said. Pictures of people you recognize with their names of what they've done. That's all it is.
I'm in the wrong profession. I could get paid so much more marketing terrible movies. Speaking of terrible movies, hey, Snow White and the Huntsman.
Ouch.
I don't want to say it's terrible. It's just,
well, you already did.
I went too far. I would just say it's pretty terrible.
I don't. Your review score was a lot more brutal than I thought it would be.
I walked out of that film. First off, I went into that film wanting to like it. That was one of my most anticipated films between April and June. And I wanted to like it, and I went into it, and I just came out just amazed at how many levels I disliked it. But Dave, since you apparently someone enjoyed the film, why don't you give us a brief synopsis of it before we talk about the flick?
Sure. So I think everybody's more or less familiar with the tale of Snow White.
No, go Dave, back on that one. You have to dumb it down a tad.
You want to dumb it down a tad?
No, go on.
Are you familiar with fairy tales? Once upon a time, there were fairy tales. So anyway, the story of Snow White, but they definitely kind of militarize it up a little bit, make it more like a supposed to be like a almost like a Lord of the Rings type epic. And I know that Matt, you've mentioned the stealing of scenes from Lord of the Rings in Rupert Sanders' film Snow White and the Huntsman. Basic premise is there's this evil queen played by Charlize Theron has the king who she had bedded. And yeah, I won't get into spoilers, but basically it's not her daughter. Snow White was the king's daughter, and she's trapped in the castle, and she's holding her prisoner for, I believe it was like 8 years or so. Eventually, Snow White escapes. She blunders into the dark forest. The queen wants her back for nefarious purposes, and she goes out and finds somebody that will hunt her down. Enter Chris Hemsworth as the huntsman. And then from there on, Snow White kind of realizes her destiny. And the huntsman is kind of there as her guide, and they gather allies along the way and eventually come back to try to overthrow the Wicked Queen. And that's pretty much the summation of it. So it uses a lot of the Snow White tropes, I guess you could say at this point, a lot of the characteristics from the original fairy tales, including, you know, the poison apple and the seven dwarves and the colors and things like that. So they did a nice job there. It was a little heavy-handed at times. But nice job incorporating the fairy tale elements into what I thought was actually a really entertaining fairy tale, but also a fantasy epic. I know you guys don't really feel the same way, so maybe I'll let you go first.
Okay.
And I can try to convince people that it's not as bad as you say it is.
Adam, I've already sort of said why I think it's as bad as I say it is. I've already sort of given my two cents. Why don't you tear Dave a new one. Let's bring him down. It's two against one, and he's clearly wrong about Snow White and Huntsman. Adam, go.
Okay. Well, like you, I really wanted to like this movie. It was also one of my most anticipated movies. Walking out of it, I found it annoyingly bad. It's as if Rupert Sanders saw Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings and said, hey, I want to do that, and then just did it all wrong. I mean, the movie is solemn to a fault. There is no levity for the first like 45 minutes of the movie. You're just in this really like droll, boring world, and everyone delivers two lines in a matter of like 10 minutes and just stretches everything out. There's no point to most of the visuals and imagery that he throws in there. He just thinks it looks cool. There's no thematic point to it. It starts with a prologue that is, I mean, it's akin to the Lord of the Rings prologue in Fellowship of the Rings. And it sets up this, you know, dark and mysterious world. And then, you know, you're like, oh, okay, now we're going to get like a hook to the story that's going to pull me in, and it's going to be kind of like a little bit light, and it's going to be fun. No, it just keeps going from really, really solemn, super serious scene to super serious scene. And then Kristen Stewart plays Snow White with this just panicky and, oh, I don't know what to do. And then in the last like half hour of the movie, she suddenly becomes this warrior who people trust for some reason. She doesn't play Snow White as a strong, heroic character. Chris Hemsworth is fine. He does what he can with the huntsman. There's really not much story given to his character. And then Charlize Theron is kind of the brightest in there. There's shades of a strong character or strong themes in her story, but Rupert Sanders never expands on that. Like, I feel like you could cut 45 minutes out of this movie and it would still be boring. There's story with the evil queen, with, you know, the downfall of of beauty and being vain. But it, I mean, you just get shades of that, and it never really expands on anything. Like, this is a movie that fails at the most basic, like, script stage. There's such a potential to have, like, a great movie here with, you know, the direction and everything that was going towards, but.
Right. Well, when you say failed at a script stage, I mean, I think we should make clear, this is clearly at least three different scripts, because you can see in the screenwriting credits, first Evan Daughtry, and then, Hossein Amini, he wrote Drive.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to, let me just check real quick who is the third writer on the film. And keep in mind, this is ignoring all the uncredited writers.
John Lee Hancock,
who did The Blind Side, and so these are people who. You know, but I was talking with Russ from Slash Film, and apparently he had read an earlier draft of the script. I think maybe the first draft. And the Huntsman dies in that one. And we know from the casting stories that the Huntsman was supposed to be an older character. And they tried getting Hugh Jackman and some other older actors, and no older actor would take the role. And they're like, fuck it, let's just make him younger. Because we have to beat Mirror Mirror to the theaters. And so they made him younger. And then there's this really half-assed sort of romantic thing between Snow White and the Huntsman that never goes anywhere, really.
No, it doesn't even work. Like, you don't even buy into it. You're like, is this like a big brother relationship, or like, what's going on here?
It's ill-defined, and there's no chemistry between Stewart and Hemsworth anyway to help illuminate that. But going back to Charlize Theron, it feels like her story is from a more interesting script that may have happened somewhere along the way, where it was this notion about female sexuality and drawing power from that, and if that sexuality wears away as a woman gets older, then that does that mean older women are powerless? And but nothing really, the film doesn't really know how to do anything more with that idea. And so, but at least Theron has something to work with. But Dave, you like the film, so
yeah.
But I think the pacing was atrocious.
I wouldn't say atrocious. I thought it lagged at some points. I mean, I can go over the whole thing. I definitely think it could have been trimmed down, edited, especially when you have a bunch of different storylines coming in to really clean them up and get rid of unneeded things. You know, if you're not going to fully realize a romantic relationship, get rid of it. I understand that you need to keep the fairy tale elements for things like that, but it's either you're in or you're not. You can't half-ass that. I will say two things. One, when I was going into this, before I actually got to see the film, I was very excited. It was also on one of my most anticipated lists. But seeing the early reviews tempered my expectations somewhat. So I think I went in there with a little more of a defense built up. So maybe I wasn't expecting quite as much as you guys were. And I think that's a case in the marketing too. If you remember, we were going back talking about Mirror Mirror and how terrible their marketing was. Now, I didn't see that film, but I believe you both saw it and you said it actually wasn't that bad. Is that right?
Yeah, I liked it.
I didn't like it.
Oh, you didn't like it?
Oh, you didn't like it.
No.
Okay, I did like it. I did. I thought it, I didn't think it was, you know, fantastic, but I thought it was had a very good idea of what it wanted to be and knew how to be that. And in fact, and surprisingly, did it with far less money and far less time and still turned out to be a pretty enjoyable film. And as opposed to Snow White and the Huntsman, which is just, I think, a mess. I mean, Dave, what about the scene where they go to, like, the Apocalypse Now village.
The little fishing village.
The little fishing village that gets set on fire. You know, like, what is the point of that scene?
Yeah, honestly, and I agree with some of your points to an extent that Sanders put a lot of these things in here just to kind of showcase his visual style, which I really like, actually. I love the visuals in this movie, and I do think that they have a point. I don't think that they're there just for him to show off. There are certain times where he wants a little bit of a change. I think they kind of just threw that scene in there to, like, inject a little bit of character development. They didn't stay there long enough to be able to do that, you know, to sort of show Snow White, Stewart's character, interacting with, you know, people for pretty much the first time, you know, villagers for pretty much the first time since she's been trapped up in this tower for 8 years. She's in pretty good shape for being trapped in a little room for 8 years,
and
by the way. She's
running all over the place. And surprisingly social. And
yeah.
Seems to be pretty okay with no mental trauma, by the way. Nothing.
No, she's perfect.
She's
fine.
A complete. Yeah, she's like, I was locked up for. I basically missed my entire youth.
See, but I don't know, man. Something about it. It's like, okay, I understand you were there, and then you got out, and let's get the story started. Like, to me, I didn't really care. It was a suspension.
See, I care
of
because it's. I care because it's an opportunity to make a more interesting character, and
true,
the film
true.
Ignores. I mean. It's something. It's a blown opportunity. It's not simply just a matter of like it's inconvenient. it really is something they could have used to their benefit. But, you know, you're talking about they keeping the four fairy tale elements. We have the seven dwarves in here, played by really good actors.
They were awesome. They were, to Adam's point about levity, they were really the only source of it in the film.
But they were wasted. I mean,
yeah, I didn't think the levity came. Like, the sense of levity that came in here, it was so... The jokes weren't well written. Like, you think of a movie like Million Dollar Baby, like, that's a really solemn movie. But the very brief parts of levity in that movie are really funny. You have to pick and choose your battles. Like, when you're doing a movie like this and when you're inserting levity, you got to make sure those jokes are really solid. And I just felt like they were just sitting like, oh, they're drunk buffoons, so that's funny enough. Like,
I don't know. It hit for the audience that I was in, and it worked with me too. I mean, they weren't like, you know, gut-bustingly funny or anything. They weren't cartoonish. They weren't on stilts like in Mirror Mirror and Run Around. But I don't know. I thought
Bob Hoskins was interesting. I thought there was
really?
More that
I felt so bad for Bob Hoskins.
Really? No,
I felt so bad for him. His dialogue is so atrocious. He's like, "You have eyes, Huntsman, but you do not see. She is the one." And I felt like I could have seen someone like, hey, he's like thinking, he says like, "There's nothing worse I could ever do than Super Mario Brothers. No matter my whole career, I'll be fine." And he gets the script for Snow White and the Huntsman. He's like, "Ah, fuck me." And he has to read this horrible dialogue. And maybe his comfort was, well, at least I don't have to say that speech that Kristen has to say when she rallies the troops.
A lot of the dialogue in this was just terrible. It really took away from the scenes. I mean, she wasn't convincing, you know, at the end with that. Again, I don't want to give away the story points, but that whole arc for her was definitely not convincing at all. And I believe that the end of it was very anticlimactic. It did not deliver on the promise that had been somewhat built up over the film.
There's no climax. The film just doesn't even have an ending. It just stops.
Yeah. It's just like, we stopped, and here's a swelling score, and then thank you for your time. We'll see you guys later. Yeah, so up until that point, I was really enjoying it. That was the only thing that really knocked it down for me. Now, maybe I have this advantage of going into the movies without really a technical understanding of a lot of these things. I couldn't look at a scene and tell you, you know, what lens they're using or what style shot this is or what tracking this is or blocking or whatever. I go into a movie, and if I enjoy it and if I remember bits and pieces of it when I come out, that's how I interpret it. So maybe by not – I don't see those technical details when I walk into a theater. I see the movie as it is. I see the performances. I experience it, and then, you know, if I enjoy it when I come out, I enjoy it when I come out. And that I think maybe separates me from you guys on this one.
No, I think you do see technical aspects. I mean, I see technical aspects when they stand out one way or the other. If it's really good cinematography, like, I'll tell you, like, oh, man, Roger Deakins is amazing. He's amazing again, because look what he does here. Or if I'll be like, hey, Tim Story, director of, like, in Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, holy shit, he set the camera down, and he's letting his actors sit in swivel chairs as they spin in and out of the frame. Holy shit, they didn't teach him not to do, no one said you shouldn't do that. Make sure your actors are in frame.
When they didn't, never mind. We're moving.
No, let's just start ripping on Tim Story. He hasn't been around in a while. Let's get that fucker.
I did like the visuals. I liked the visuals a lot. And, you know, Rupert Sanders comes from commercials. And Matt, you were there at Comic-Con with me last year in Hall H. And he showed a scissor reel that he made that helped him get the job of doing Snow White and the Huntsman. And he basically – it was essentially the first trailer that we saw for this movie. A lot of the visuals were taken straight out of that. And it had the Evil Queen coming out of the white goo. And I read an interview with him where he said that we really liked that visual, but it didn't make sense in the story. But we wanted to try and fit it in there, so we just kind of found a place to do it. That was an example of a scene that came up for me when I was like, "There's no point to this." Like, I'm watching her, and
it's never that, really explained what that does for her.
Like, no, and it's just something that looks cool. Which
no, it kind of does. I think they went back to it later on when they showed the sort of flashback to her, Queen Ravenna, as a child. And her mother or whatever it was.
Oh, she drinks that. Like, oh, yeah, she drinks.
Yeah,
like
it's like that thick milk kind of.
Oh, so
yeah,
she has to dip herself in like youth milk.
Yeah, definitely.
Youth, but she also has to. Sure. But she also has to suck youth out of young people. So she has like multiple ways of getting young. But she's
just so many.
She's
ways,
out of youth milk, so she has to get like maidens because she's out of the youth milk.
She doesn't have a formula.
By the way, can I just also say, doesn't the youth milk like look like the stuff from Wanted, like the donut,
yeah,
like the donut glazed bath?
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah, like apparently.
But dude, I mean, like, can we talk about the visuals just in this movie? Because for me, like, I think that was really what made this experience great when I watched this movie and I was really into it. The contrast and the range of these visuals, going from the dark forest with these sort of psychotropic mushrooms, and I mean, I would not want to be in that forest. That was like one of the first forests I've seen in like a fantasy epic where I was like, holy shit, I do not want to be in that place. And then when they transition over to this sort of like everything is blooming, everything's alive, there's fairy creatures, there's colors, there's these mythical creatures. I love that. I just love the visual scene. I honestly couldn't care less about the characters at that point. I was just really into the visuals.
But at that point, why not just, like, can we just show you a screensaver and call it a day?
Sure, dude. I mean, I'll sit there for 2 hours, just watch a screensaver. It was great.
I would like to see Sanders take the time to develop, like, a really good story. I think he does have talent behind the camera.
Well, and let's be fair. How much control did he really have over this story? I think my criticism for him isn't necessarily the story. It's the storytelling and where he chooses to put his emphasis, and it doesn't feel like he's putting it in towards working with his actors or really coming up with visuals that have thematic weight.
Maybe that was his crutch then. He's trying to take this hodgepodge of a script together, and he's like, well, can't really do a whole lot with this, so let's at least make it pretty.
Right, but I think you can make it pretty and still thoughtful.
True.
Because without that, you basically anyone can make really pretty images. I don't really, and someone just gave him a budget to make more pretty images. So I don't hold the script against him. Mm-hmm. And so you're right. Maybe when he has a better story, a more inspired story, he can do something. But I look at this and I see a guy who I am not. His name does not make me excited.
You wouldn't go see something else that he did though, the next project.
Based solely on his name alone, no, I wouldn't. It would take other aspects.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be interested to see what he does next, though. I don't know if we have anything lined up for him.
I'm sure. I mean, the film did well this weekend, so he'll be on.
Yeah.
We're talking about getting the sequel going quickly with him directing again.
Hooray! Yeah. David Koepp writing.
Yeah. Oh, it's just like a prequel with like the Huntsman. I guess, you know, he's a widower. So I guess they're getting into his story, which, I mean, I feel like if they can choose one character and develop that character, I think that, I don't know, maybe that has a possibility of working, but...
That's a fucking stupid prequel. Because really, like, where does he get into, like, where does he even, like, I really wanted to know how he got into that drunken bar fight.
True, yeah.
Like, that's, what a terrible prequel to go for. I would rather see a prequel based around Ravenna.
Exactly, like, yeah, I mean, they touched on that, yeah.
Like, that's an interesting, like... to see how she became who she is, because she alludes to how she's conquered many kingdoms before. So right, I would like to, like, if like her, like, kind of rise to power and her relationship with her brother, I think that's the meat for a prequel. Like, the Huntsman, it's like, that's something you can...
He already told the story. He already told her when he was having his little soliloquy there, when he was talking to, I won't ruin it, but when he's talking towards the end of the film, and he's like, just gives his whole story up, and it's like, oh, okay, sounds good. Yep. Don't really need to see that for 90 minutes or 2 hours.
Actually, I take that back. The prequel I want to see is just Snow White in the Tower for like 8 years. Just like her building her dolls, like reading a Bible that, by the way, saying the Lord's Prayer, and that just has nothing else to do with anything else in the movie. It's mostly a pagan film with pagan visuals, but then it's like, and then there's like this weird Christian thing sticking out like a sore crucifix, you know? It's
Jesus.
Oh, God.
Exactly, Dave. Jesus.
Oh, God. Now that I had no clue. I was scratching my head about that. No clue where that came from. If he was trying to make the thing like an allegory, you know, like I was waiting for more Christ figure.
It felt very much like because it looks cool. Because it sounds cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know. It was pretty strange. Pretty strange.
All right. It is strange.
But it is not a D-. I think it's worth a watch.
The grade is it's not a D-, nor a sad face plus. I mean, I mean, come on. I mean, it is just a letter. I mean, that's a guidepost rather than, I mean, the letter is an idea. But I get what you're saying. You wouldn't, given the same subjective scale, you would not have graded it that low.
No, and I enjoyed it. So, I mean, if people are listening and they're on the fence about it, I say go check it out. The other guys say, well, I don't know what you say. Don't want to put words in your mouth.
Well, the people I went with enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
the people I saw it with did not enjoy
There were like 10 people that walked out of the theater, though. Like, not even like towards the beginning. It was right before the denouement. Like, right
People were walking out at my screen as well, because they're like, fuck it, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
They're like, nothing here can happen that I really care about.
Huh. No, I did not expect that. I was entertained. You know, I was disappointed in the end, but I was entertained throughout, so.
All right. Okay, well, and that was the last time you ever heard of Dave on The Collision. Next week on The Collision, not Dave Trumbore.
Not Dave.
All right, so let's move on to our recommendations. I'll kick it off. This week, at the Cannes Film Festival, Michael Haneke's Amour won the Palme d'Or, the top prize at the film festival, and it was his second time winning the award. The first time came with The White Ribbon, which is my selection for the week, and it's a really fantastic film. The film came out in 2009, so considering that short amount of time to win two really prestigious awards, that's pretty impressive. But the film takes place in a fictional German, small German village, in the years just before World War I, so this great war is coming. And in the village, these mysterious deaths start to happen. And you get the strong indication that the children are behind it. But it's not like a village of the damned thing. In fact, what Haneke does is he sort of takes us into this great sort of class warfare, almost between the village of sort of the barons and the baronesses and then these workers, and what the children of the rich people are sort of above reproach, but the children of the workers are starting their eyes being cast on them. And it's a gorgeous film, but what really hooked me into it is it really got that sense of early 20th century dread of this coming nightmare of man's inhumanity to man. And you sort of see it in Edvard Munch's The Scream or Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis, this notion of how brutally people will treat each other, and then specifically in reference to war. And I think one of the really interesting things The White Ribbon does is because the children, the World War I is about to come, and these children will be too young to fight in it. So this horror is coming soon, but after the war has ended, these children will be old enough to not have any visceral emotional connection to it, and these are the children who will become soldiers in World War II. And I just thought that was really fascinating. And even though the film's about 145 minutes, it doesn't feel long. You just get sucked in by these performances and this gorgeous cinematography from Christian Berger, and the score is fantastic. And so even though it's definitely like an art house film through and through, that doesn't mean you should ignore it. It's a film completely worth your time. It's gorgeous, it's thoughtful, and I highly recommend checking it out. And I can't wait to check out Amour and see what Haneke did there. So The White Ribbon is my recommendation for this week. Adam, what do you got for us?
I am going to recommend another film that features Kristen Stewart. I'm going to go with Into the Wild, a 2007 film directed by Sean Penn. And it's based on a true story that was chronicled in John Krakauer's book of the same name. And it basically follows this guy named Christopher McCandless, who graduated from Emory University with high honors and then just decided to destroy all of his credit cards and IDs, donate his life savings to charity, and roam North America for 2 years before he eventually landed up in Alaska. He didn't have family troubles. There wasn't any like big glaring thing that would have caused this. He just left his life. And it's a really interesting, not only is it an interesting case study of what this guy did and what happened to him, but it's also a fascinating look at, like, I don't know, I know me and like a bunch of my friends, like, if you've ever had that feeling of like, what would it be like just to up and leave and just go and just travel, what that does to a person on the inside, and what that does like with humanity and everything. Kristen Stewart is actually really good in this. She has a small but memorable role as a girl that he meets at the squatter and red camp known as Slab City in southeastern California. The film is full of just a hodgepodge of a bunch of great supporting performances. Marsha Gay Harden and William Hurt play his parents. Jenna Malone plays his sister. We see Catherine Keener in a really nice role. Vince Vaughn, Zach Galifianakis is actually in this in a dramatic role. and Hal Holbrook gives kind of a heart-crushing performance that he was nominated for the Oscar for. But I highly recommend this movie, and I also highly recommend the book by John Krakauer. It's kind of a tough read because a lot of it has a bunch of Christopher McCandless's journal entries while he was alone and kind of stuck in Alaska and stuff like that. But really fascinating movie. I suggest that you do not watch this alone because you can get very depressed.
Indeed. So, Dave, pick us back up. What do you got for us?
So since you guys each did a recommendation that was based on a true story, I'm going to continue that trend based on historical.
Motif. I don't know, but you're go on. It's not based on facts.
Well, that's cool. The punchline was that I was going to recommend Willow, so now that joke is destroyed.
And that's what you get for liking Snow White and the Huntsman. I'm going to destroy all your jokes.
Back
now.
To Snow White and the Huntsman. You should check it out just for Oscar winner Colleen Atwood's costume design. Anyway, so we're going to go with the action adventure Willow from 1988. Directed by Ron Howard from a story by George Lucas, actually, who's been in the news lately. So we'll see if he's going to make Willow 2 in his garage when he goes back to tinkering, making new movies. But anyway, this movie was another great sort of the 80s fantasy epics, one of my favorite films as a kid. This stars Warwick Davis as Willow Ufgood. He's a I can't remember what they called the sort of the dwarf characters that were in this film. But he basically comes into possession of a human child that is sought after by this evil queen, Queen Bev Morda, played by Jean Marsh. And he goes on this quest to basically he has to protect the baby from her the entire time. And he comes across these characters such as Val Kilmer, who plays Mad Mardigan, kind of a sellsword, a mercenary that is caught up in this cage kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And there's a really good rapport between Davis and Kilmer. And their characters have a really cool arc throughout the progression of the film. There's also Joanne Whalley plays Sorsha, who starts off as a soldier for the Queen's Army, and she ends up having a really nice arc towards the end too. And it also features the one thing I was really looking forward to in Snow White and the Huntsman was this standoff between Kristen Stewart's Snow White and Charlize Theron's Queen Ravenna. And unfortunately, it didn't quite pay off in the way that I had wanted it to. And one of my comparisons to that is the standoff between two sorceresses in Willow. It's definitely a great woman-on-woman magical battle that takes place about two-thirds of the way through the film. Definitely worth a watch. Some great 80s special effects in there that are definitely a little bit dated, but it's a good mix of action, drama, good story. It's a little cheesy at times, but I mean, hey, it was an 80s fantasy epic. Definitely check out Willow if you haven't so far.
Okay, so the recommendations this week are The White Ribbon, Into the Wild, and Willow. Thanks for listening, everyone. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at CollisionCast. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave, where can we find you on Twitter?
Find me at Snow White and the Huntsman Forever. You can actually find me at Dr. Claw MD.
And that Twitter name is why we forgive you for liking Snow White and the Huntsman.
Appreciate that.
Tune in next week when we will be talking about Prometheus. That'll be a fun one. And whatever other news that breaks. So thanks for listening, and we'll talk. You'll hear from us next week.
Thanks, guys.
See you next time.